from her debut recital at Carnegie Recital Hall to the Broadway pits of Les Mis and Miss Saigon, oboist Blair Tindall has played with some of the biggest names in classical music for 25 years. She was the principal oboe in the Hudson Valley Philharmonic based in Poughkeepsie for 13 years. In her memoir, Mozart in the Jungle, Tindall exposes the scandalous rock and roll lifestyles of the musicians, conductors, and administrators who inhabit the insular world of classical music. The book came out in 2005 and really shook things up and became a Amazon instant video series about love, ambition, and jealousy backstage at the symphony. The series debuted in December and was recently renewed for a second season on Amazon. Blair Tindall joins us now to talk about Mozart in the Jungle, as well as other stories, and it's a great pleasure to welcome her to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me, Joe.
Very nice to have you here. It's fascinating because I'm curious. The book comes out, it creates a splash. You tick some people off. We'll talk about that. And then, at what point does it come to your attention that somebody's interested in doing this as a series?
Immediately.
Really?
The very first review was in Entertainment Weekly. It was the book of the week. And Jason Schwartzman, who's the nephew of Francis Ford Coppola, saw it and called my agent. He was involved at the time with a big movie project, the Darjeeling Express, and I was dragging my feet because I was new in Hollywood and didn't understand you can't drag your feet. And so he disappeared for a couple of years, but he came back in 2008, and we signed a deal. I signed a deal with him, and he shopped it around. We got an HBO deal, and maybe 2011, and had that for a couple of years, and then they dropped us in favor of the HBO series Girls, which is actually quite similar but has a broader audience appeal.
Right.
So at that point, Amazon was just getting started. Nobody'd heard of Amazon Studios, and Jason came back about 3 months later and said, "We have a deal with Amazon." And I said, "What is Amazon?" So now I know. So that's how it all happened.
When you think of its accessibility, meaning the work, I'm assuming at no time in writing this, did you ever think that it could become a series, that you were just interested in telling the stories?
Not at all. I was at three artist colonies when I wrote it. I was awash in screenwriting books, and I was trying to write it in the basic three-act structure with cliffhangers so that it would appeal to big screen, small screen producers. I mean, that was exactly what I had in mind.
Okay.
And I really tried hard to make that work, and I think it did.
When you think of the story, the ultimate story that you wanted to tell was that it was the surprise is the lifestyle that these musicians led. Right?
Well, remember, some of this was in the 80s and 90s, so you know, there were certain trends then, like certain Studio 54 was still open
right
at the beginning of the book, so was Plato's Retreat. Things are very different now. You know, a lot of the people in the book who were, you know, really had substance abuse issues don't even drink coffee now.
So, but has it changed drastically? I mean, is it a completely different world where just the world collectively has cleaned up its act, or this particular sector of it?
No, I wouldn't. I mean, I think people are people, no matter
sure
what the era. I think there's always a cross section of people in any industry, and they just, you know, there are people who are very devoted and would never misbehave. There are people at the other end of the spectrum, and they just, you know, probably have a little different style now. The people my age and older who are in the book, we can't really behave like that anymore. We're too old. But, you know, I'm sure the younger folks have their fun. The book was really, I went to journalism school about 15 years ago, and the book grew out of a class that I had taken. And it was really meant to be about the rise of culture in late 20th century America. That was the point of the book. And I knew nobody was going to buy that book, nor would it ever be a movie or TV show.
Right.
So because this story paralleled my life, I decided to weave in memoir and, you know, had quite the roadmap of, you know, when this kind of funding was happening, what was I doing? You know, what did it look like from the inside? So that was the point. But I did try to make it I mean, there have been complaints that there's not enough sex in it. Not enough sex, not enough drugs. But I did try to make it, you know, so that people saw us as real people instead of these elite penguins on stage who, you know, they think we live in Trump Tower in the penthouse and walk around in smoking jackets eating caviar, which we don't.
No. You know, you said something a moment ago of you assume the younger generation is still having some amount of fun. How much of what you were doing and is replicated in the book was indeed fun? And how much of it do you think got out of hand?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Sure. You were talking a moment ago about this new generation saying, I assume that they have time to go out and have some fun. I'm interested in, during your time and with your contemporaries, how much of that was actually fun?
Well, I have to say, especially when you're on tour and you're seeing all these fabulous foreign places, there's a lot of fun to be had, and you're traveling together. It's like you're a tribe. It's like you're a family.
Yeah.
So that sort of thing really is a lot of fun. I mean, certain people abuse substances. A lot of the cocaine users, I was not one, by the way, seemed to be having a great time doing it. I think the people who had trouble with alcohol abuse did it more to deal with stress, which can be very high because it's just very difficult to find work, keep work, not much job security outside of the, you know, regular major orchestra scene like the New York Philharmonic. So I think a certain amount of substance abuse was very depressed. I mean, it led to depression. It grew out of depression. Also, remember, in the 80s, it was kind of the era before AIDS came about, and women had the pill. So it was this time of sexual abandon without suffering consequences. So that part actually was quite a lot of fun, and everybody was doing it. I was not alone.
Was it... Did it ever, do you think, when looking back on it, did it ever impact the work? Did it ever impact what you were doing as the oboist on stage?
Not really, because I would never, ever, you know, go play a classical concert under the influence, because it's just, I mean, you feel like you're naked on stage. It's such a highly technical thing. I have to say, I did occasionally show up in a Broadway pit of a show that I knew very, very well after having a few glasses of wine. But, you know, I knew the show backwards and forwards, but I would never, I don't think many people would consider doing that before a classical concert.
Mm. In the, how much of it is the city? I mean, as I mentioned, you were the, you were an oboist in the Hudson Valley Philharmonic. I mean, is that a different life just because you're away from the city?
Well, I lived in the city. We commuted back and forth every night.
Right.
So, you know, that's Tales of the Carpool, a family in itself.
And where it would go. And you mentioned this, and you talk about this in the book, about this family nature. And, yes, it's a family, but it's a pretty dysfunctional family.
Yeah, very much so. There's a very fine orchestra in New York called the Orchestra of St. Luke's, really wonderful players. And I think, you know, this no longer applies, but that was kind of cocaine central there. Mm. And I felt like an outcast whenever I subbed in the orchestra because I wasn't doing cocaine. There's actually a dealer who was also a sub in the orchestra who was doing it back, you know, dealing backstage, just like in the show, during concerts. Most of them, you know, it's a whole new crowd of people, and the older ones, I'm sure, have all given that up. And also the orchestra has just gotten so prominent. I think everybody realizes they can't behave that way.
So 2005, the book comes out, and the reaction from your fellow players and for those that were thinly veiled here as to who, you know, who was doing what was the response?
Well, first of all, the vast majority of people in the book, I meant to represent them positively as sort of unsung heroes who work so hard and are unrecognized. And really, most of these people, their real names are in the book. For legal purposes, in a couple of cases, I did use pseudonyms, and for one person in particular, I wanted, you know, her identity not to be out there, so I did use a pseudonym for her. And the pseudonyms are on the copyright page. Well, it was half, the response was half and half. About half of the musicians who actually read the book really loved it and just felt like, thank God people can see us finally. And also just the data that I came up with, and I did a huge amount of research about how culture developed in America, was news to most people, and it had not been explored in much detail in many books. The other half, and, you know, everyone's entitled to their opinion, and my feelings certainly aren't hurt if somebody reads it and dislikes it, but the vast majority of people who lash out at me and hate the book haven't actually opened it,
yeah.
I've found, and other people have said that as well. I met an English oboist out here in L.A. I live in Los Angeles recently, and he read the book and loved it, and he went home to England and, you know, got the same response, oh, I hate that book, and, you know, she's left her way to the bottom. I guess the New York Philharmonic is the bottom. you know, and he said, well, have you read it? And in his experience, not one person he asked had actually read it. So I think there's an assumption about what's in it that is not right. But, you know, so many musicians are so happy about the show because it makes us real, and it's almost like a music video, or I like to say, you know, people are getting their classical music and realizing they love it without, you know, having to sit still and wonder where to clap.
How much input do you get in the show? I mean, obviously the book is the source material, and do you just, are you there if they need you, or do you want an active role in it?
Well, the first season I was a consultant, so, yeah. You know, especially for classical music protocol, the director would contact me pretty often and ask questions to try to make the scene look realistic. Aside from that, if you've got the Coppola family making a TV show out of your life story, I think it's probably good to just let them have at it.
Right, let them do it. And then you see it and you think, wow, this is a fair and a nice representation of what I have written.
I could not be happier. I really love everything they did. And, you know, there's a certain shorthand that you have to use in television and film, or else, you know, the TV show would be hours long.
Right.
So, you know, you have a certain small number of seconds to, you know, get some point across or get somebody's personality across. So, you know, there are a lot of complaints in the classical music world that it's not realistic, but do you really want to sit there and watch somebody practice scales and orchestra excerpts for a half hour?
No. No, we don't. And so season two, that's very exciting. So season one launches in December, and you find out about season two, and it's out there, and people seem excited. That's very cool. It doesn't get much better than that.
It really doesn't. And that was I knew it was already signed for season two, renewed, but
yeah.
It was very exciting to, you know, see the news last week, and then I was signed by a major Hollywood agency the same day. So that was also very exciting.
Which means what? With the goal of that arrangement being what?
Well, I now have an agent for books, for screenplays, for reality shows, and for anything else that comes about, like public speaking engagements.
Oh, there you go.
So all in one place. And they have so much talent attached. It's the Gersh Agency, that if I do, you know, get a scripted series going, another one, you know, they may be able to attach some of their talent very easily, whereas on my own, that would be almost impossible.
Reality show, that's interesting, wouldn't it?
That did come up, yeah.
Yeah, that would be interesting. Blair Tindall's book is called Mozart in the Jungle. It is published by Grove. The series is available on Amazon Instant Video, and if you just go to Amazon and put it in Mozart in the Jungle, you can find out how you can access it there. Blair Tindall, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program, and wish you all the luck in the world in the future.
Thank you so much for having me, Joe.
Thank you. We post all of our segments online, wamc.org/roundtable. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.